Thanks for the invitation to speak to you guys about my recent work and really the work of my group in Stockholm and collaborators across many different places. So they're listed here. I'll talk about my Stockholm collaborators on the next slide too. So today I'll talk about Core Collab Supernova and particularly kind of focus on how we can use them as laboratories for probing fundamental physics. And I tried to focus on the strong gravity stuff. So this is my group in Stockholm. In the top left is Aurore. She's a PhD student and she works on neutrino interactions and transport processes in supernova. Shuai and Andre are two postdocs, and they work on gravitational waves and equations of state. Mostly the main things I'm going to talk about today. And so most of the work is their work. And then Samuel and Oliver are our master students. Oliver just finished, and Samuel is a current master student. Okay, so supernovae are really intimately linked to many parts of astronomy and astrophysics. So they come from massive stars. So stars more than 10 solar masses. So these guys up here start out as O stars and B stars, very bright, very blue. Most of them become supergiants, blue supergiants or yellow or red supergiants at the end of their life, and then they blow up as a core collapse supernova. So probing or understanding supernova lets us probe massive stars. In a lot of cases for supernovae, we can go back and find the star that blew up with pre-explosion images from Hubble or something. And so we can probe what stars look like when they blow up. Supernovae, at least a particular subtype of supernovae, type 1c broadline supernovae, are associated with long gamma ray bursts, some long gamma ray bursts. And so we know that there is a massive star connection there and a supernova explosion connection to long gamma ray bursts. We're not quite sure exactly still what happens in order to cause these energetic supernova, but they definitely involve the death of massive stars. And in all cases, when a core collapses, you either form a neutron star or a black hole. You always have a remnant. And those then can go on to form binaries and make neutron star binaries, neutron star black hole binaries, or black hole binaries. And then, you know, sometime in the future may merge, and we can see that as gravitational waves. So all the black holes and neutron stars that LIGO sees and LIGO and Virgo see are the end products of supernova. On much more larger scales, on galactic scales, supernovae, the energy that they inject, the 10 to the 51 ergs roughly, goes into controlling the evolution of galaxies. So they trigger star formation, but they also regulate it. So they turn off star formation at different parts in the evolution of galaxies. So the even though it's one single event, the energy is so large that it really can affect the evolution of the galaxy. On the other hand, when the energy is 10 to the 51 ergs is actually quite small. So most of the energy is emitted in neutrinos. So 100 times more energy is emitted in neutrinos. And they don't interact the same way and drive the evolution of galaxies. But in 87, from supernova 1987A, we saw roughly 20 neutrinos from a supernova in the Large Magellanic Cloud. And nowadays with current detectors and for galactic supernova, we haven't seen anything, but we expect to see thousands of neutrinos from a particular event. Both types of supernovae, the massive star supernovae, which I've been talking most about, and type 1a supernovae, which are from thermonuclear explosions of white dwarfs. There are two types of supernova. The type 1as help us understand cosmology, so the early evolution of the universe and probing the acceleration of the universe. And so this was one of the main reasons why we search for type 1a supernovae, especially high redshift ones. Both of the supernovae contribute to galactic nucleosynthesis. And so the yellow elements is elements that come from or the portions of elements that come from exploding stars, whether elements made during the life of a star or during the explosion itself. Gray is from the type 1a supernovae, and then purple we think are coming from merging neutron stars, which the neutron stars themselves come from supernovae. So supernovae are connected to many of the elements that we have in the universe. And then finally, there's this wonderful site for exploring extreme physics. So extreme densities and temperatures and neutron to proton ratios that we really, in some cases, can't even reproduce on the Earth. And so neutron stars are really the only environment for this. And the trouble then is, you know, using the laboratory to see something. So that's a bit about how supernovae are connected to the rest of astronomy. Today, I'm going to focus on the physics of core collapse supernovae. And in particular, two things. I'm going to focus on some work that Schwai has done on the hadron quark phase transition in supernova, and the nuclear equation state effects, and what we think are the current, you know, important parameters in the nuclear equation state that impact core collapse supernovae. I'm probably not going to have time to talk about neutrinos as messengers, but we'll see when we get there. And then I'm going to talk some about parameterized explosion models and the current state of that. So massive stars spend most of their life burning hydrogen, probably 90-95%. The rest of that is spent burning, most of the rest is spent burning helium, and then really a small fraction is spent burning the rest of the elements in the core all the way up to iron. You can't go past iron, or you could, but you're not going to get any energy out of it, so it's not very effective at holding up a star against gravitational collapse. And iron itself can hold itself up for a little bit with electron degeneracy pressure, but there is a maximum mass there. So once you burn enough silicon and your iron core gets to a particular size, then it's going to collapse because there's no pressure that can support it. And this happens in most massive stars when the star is a red supergiant. So this is a Hubble Space Telescope picture of Betelgeuse. It's has a radius of 1,000 solar radii. And the iron core that's in the center when it collapses in that last week or so is really only a millionth of the radius of the star. So very small iron core in the center. And as I said, collapse happens when that iron core becomes too massive and is not able to support itself with available pressures. So essentially electron degeneracy pressure. And not until you get to nuclear densities, when all the nucleons start to interact with each other, do you get a pressure that can support the star against gravity. And in that process of collapsing from an iron core to ultimately a neutron star, you release a huge amount of energy. So 300 times 10 to the 51 ergs. And it's that energy that is ultimately responsible for blowing up the star, ejecting the material, making some new elements, and radiating lots of neutrinos. So it's this, the energy source in a core collapse supernova is the gravitational binding energy. Unlike type 1As, where the energy source is burning of carbon and oxygen to iron. So the iron core starts out at a density of around 10 to the 9 grams per cubic centimeter, and collapse will go all the way to a few times 10 to the 14 before it stops. It gets to 10 to the 12 about 5 milliseconds before that nuclear density. And at that point, around 10 to the 12, a couple of things happen. The material is traveling or starts to become supersonic. So the infalling material is traveling faster than the speed of sound. And so that's the sonic point is kind of delineating that. The inner core is in sonic contact. The stuff out here is supersonically falling in. And also at this time, the neutrinos start to become trapped. And so the density is high enough, that the opacity is high enough for neutrinos not to just stream away. So 5 milliseconds later, you get to nuclear densities. So densities of around 10 to the 14. And this is now when the interaction between the neutrons and protons, mostly neutrons, is able to supply a pressure. So this is the nuclear force, is able to supply a pressure to hold up the core against further collapse. And so it is collapsing. There's lots of negative velocity. So it overshoots this new equilibrium, compresses, and then rebounds. This is what we call bounce. Rebounds and sends a pressure wave out. And that pressure wave steepens into a shock wave. And that is the shock wave that will ultimately blow up the star for a successful supernova. And so what happens though, after, you know, in the first hundreds of milliseconds after that shock is formed, shock goes out to about 150 kilometers or so, but it stalls. And so there's two reasons why it stalls. One, the main reason is why does it stall? The pressure inside the shock that's pushing the material out is smaller than the ram pressure of the material outside that's pushing the shock down. So you have infalling material that's keeping the shock confined, and then inside the shock is hot material that wants to push the shock out. It's not hot enough to do this though. And one way it loses energy is the nuclei that are outside, like the iron group nuclei that the star spent its whole life making, hit the shock and dissociate and into free neutrons and protons. But that takes a lot of energy. So these nuclei are falling supersonically, but about 40% of the energy, of that kinetic energy, goes into heat and breaks up the nucleus. And then the rest of it goes into heat and becomes thermal energy. But a lot of the energy just goes into internal energy, so it breaks it up. And then you have less thermal pressure than you would have otherwise if you didn't have to invest this energy breaking up the particle. And then you also have hot material that's radiating neutrinos, and so this also takes away energy. So that's what causes the shock to stall. And re-energizing the shock is the goal of supernova theory, what we work on. And the prevailing mechanism is the turbulence-aided neutrino mechanism. So this is where you have neutrinos coming from this blue region. That's where it's hot, very hot, and lots of neutrinos are being emitted. They stream out away from the protoneutron star that's in the core. And they interact with some material out here in the red region. And so what defines the color here is just the change in energy due to the interaction with neutrinos. So red regions where neutrinos are preferentially being absorbed on the material and injecting energy into the material and heating it. So the red region is the heating region, and that's where the internal energy of the material is increasing because it's absorbing neutrinos. And so this heating of the material helps raise that thermal pressure and helps drive the explosion. It's not enough for the heating alone. You also need the benefit of the effective pressure you get from turbulence. And so this material is turbulent, and this requires multidimensional modeling. But that turbulence pressure is able to also aid in the explosion. And it's very successful in 2D and 3D in blowing up stars. And so now I'll show a couple of examples of this. We're able to predict explosions with full state-of-the-art multidimensional 3D simulations. So I'll show a couple of those. So this is an example of that. The color is entropy, and the brighter the color, the higher the entropy. And so you can see the turbulence, the inner part is the neutron star, the cyan is the shock, supernova shock. And the turbulent motions of the material you can see. This particular simulation doesn't explode, and so the shock doesn't get revived. There's not enough neutrino heating and turbulence to overcome that ram pressure. But as you can see, it's very non-spherically symmetric. So the multidimensional character is very important. Before I show some examples of multidimensional simulations, I just want to show you that One of the things we've recently done as a community is get together and all simulate exactly the same problem with our codes that we use for, or many of the codes we use for the multi-D simulations that we do. So we just want to make sure that when we simulate things in spherical symmetry, we get the same result between all the codes. And ideally, we would like to do this in 3D as well, but that's a much bigger endeavor. So we'll start with spherical symmetry. And I think we have very excellent agreement between all these codes. So on the left is the shock radius. These are spherically symmetric, so they don't blow up. The shock goes out and stalls and then recedes. And so ultimately not successful. But the shock radius evolution is very similar in all these six codes that we use. Completely independent, almost completely independent codes, completely independent implementations and microphysics. But the point is we made sure that we were all doing the same thing, even though we have our own implementations. And on the right is the neutrino luminosity. And so the neutrino luminosity is important because that's what drives the neutrino heating. And the neutrino heating drives the convection and the turbulence. And so it's important to get this right as well. And for this progenitor, most of the codes can predict this neutrino luminosity within, you know, a few percent of each other in the first few hundred milliseconds. So I think when we simulate the same problem, we get very similar answers. And now I'll just show two examples in the literature of successful multidimensional simulations. So these are simulations by the Princeton group. They have done 14 simulations and 11 of them are successful. So the shock comes out, stalls, but then gets revived and is sent off throughout the rest of the star. Only three of them are not successful, the 13, the 14, and the 15 here. The rest are successful. And this is an example from the Gresham group with their three-dimensional code. And also here, not only did they simulate 7 seconds of a 3D simulation, they also simulated 7 minutes prior to what you see here of the final 7 minutes of the iron core's life. And so this is to capture the multidimensional structure of the different burning shells that are happening in the star at the end of its life. And so those end up being very crucial to seed the turbulence that ultimately drives the explosion. And here they get, after 7 seconds, you know, canonical explosion energies that we expect from core collapse supernova of 10 to the 51 Hertz, which has been a problem in core collapse theory, achieving these energies, but now we can do this.
Evan, do you mind if I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
If you go back to the previous slide, the one that showed the successful and unsuccessful explosion, so is it understood why sometimes it's successful, sometimes it's not? I mean, is that something you control, or you just launch a simulation and you see what you get and you scratch your head about, you know, what happened?
Yeah. Not usually. Usually there's an explanation. So for example, if I go back to these 1D simulations, see, there's this feature here in most massive stars at the interface between the silicon shell and the oxygen shell. So most of these in the low density silicon oxygen shells, it's essentially an ideal gas. So if you have silicon and oxygen, silicon's much bigger as an element. And so you need to have the same pressure, you need a higher density of silicon. And so at this interface, where the composition changes dramatically, the density changes dramatically too. And so the oxygen has a density that's 50% lower than the silicon. So when this accretes through the shock, all of a sudden your RAM pressure, how much stuff you're accreting, drops by factor 2. And then this is often in multi-D, not in spherical symmetry, but in multi-D, this is often the time when it's easiest to launch an explosion, because you still have the heating from the high accretion rate, but you don't have the high accretion rate, so you can blow up. And so that's what happens in a lot of these simulations. So close to when this interface accretes in, which is different in all models, Sometimes it does accrete in as early as 150 milliseconds. Then explosions are usually launched. In some progenitors, this, just because of stellar evolution, you don't have such an interface, or you do, but the density contrast isn't very big. And so in those particular models, it's harder to drive an explosion because you don't have that ideal conditions. And I think that is what's happening in these models here.
Okay, so yeah, because I was a bit puzzled by the fact that those simulations seem to be only distinguished by mass, and I wasn't clear why. Well, so the color coding escapes me here, but so yeah, so I wasn't sure how to interpret this.
Result. Progenitor structure is not, you know, a smooth function of zero age main sequence mass, and so you often have. Sometimes it's not always the case, but sometimes the case that, you know, a 13 is more likely to be similar to a 14 than a 20, but it's not guaranteed to be similar. So there is kind of, there is lots of structural differences between massive stars at the end of their lives. But here it is kind of the case that these 13, 14, and 15 kind of do have a similar structure compared to the rest of them. Not that the other ones aren't different as well. They are different, but it's not necessarily going to be a smooth function of zero age main sequence mass. I mean, that's the naive picture and what you find in textbooks, but it's not ultimately what we're seeing.
Okay, thanks.
I have some more on this on the end. So we can talk more about it then. So we have done simulations too in 3D, but we don't get any explosions, and so it's not as nice results. But we do have lots of interesting physics that you really can only see in 3D. So, for example, we explore the effect of progenitor perturbations and multidimensional or three-dimensional instabilities like the SASE and the LISA. Asymmetry. So I'll just quickly show the effect of progenitor perturbations, which I mentioned here was crucial for getting an explosion, the fact that they simulated 7 minutes before the collapse. And this kind of just shows that. This is a star right before it's about to core collapse, and it's simulated in 3D. And this is a silicon shell that's almost void of silicon. So there's just a little bit of silicon left. So these darker areas is like 10% silicon. And that's burning. That's what you see down here. This, the red colors are energy production from burning. And that's driving lots of convection. And so these are the velocities in the shell, the silicon burning shell. And once you burn it to enough iron, then the core will collapse. So when we put perturbations in our simulations, we do see that they bring us closer to explosion. So the perturbations that are in these shells, for example, the silicon shell, seed the turbulence and allow the turbulence to develop much more quickly than if we don't have any perturbations in there. So these red simulations are simulations where we put in turbulence in the, or put in perturbations in the silicon shell. And the shock radiuses are larger in these simulations, and we have more turbulence. So we have more lateral kinetic energy as a measure of the turbulence. And they're quantitatively closer to explosion, even though they still don't explode. And this turbulence that is in the gain region that brings you closer to explosion also excites the protoneutron star and gives rise to gravitational waves. So we can kind of use gravitational waves as a probe of how much turbulence there is in the gain region of these simulations. So these are, yeah, again, a simulation without perturbations, the blue one and the green one, and then with perturbations, the red one and the pink one. And this is, you can see the kind of signal in the gravitational wave spectrogram here. This is a movie of these two simulations. So on the left without perturbations and on the right with perturbations. And they're put in the silicon shell. And so when that silicon shell accretes through the shock, which happens starting now up to about 200 milliseconds, then you start to see this much more strong turbulence. And so you can see the visual difference. The one on the right, larger shock radius, stronger turbulence, both ultimately don't explode. But the perturbation one is closer. It doesn't count, I guess. Okay, any questions about any of that before I go on to the some other stuff?
Evan, so yesterday we learned that this neutrino flavor conversion might be important for binary neutron star mergers, and is also important in supernovas?
Yes. Yeah. It's really hard to say because we don't really have a good understanding of how neutrino oscillations work. We don't, because you know it's very much up in the air. There's two types of kind of collective oscillations. There's the classical collective oscillations, which probably don't affect the dynamics in a core collapse because they don't happen till far enough out. The neutrino density has to drop to a certain amount before they can start to oscillate. And so probably these classical collective oscillations probably don't do anything. The more recent kind of fast flavor oscillations, which is maybe what you are talking about, could happen in supernova. It seems like they need more, the conditions are not perfect in supernova. They're not as good as in supernova as they are in mergers because you need a lot of electron antineutrinos compared to neutrinos. And in a supernova, you start with an iron core, you have lots of electrons. And this generally keeps the electron neutrino density larger than the electron antineutrino density. So this, you know, is not conducive for fast flavor oscillations. Whereas in a merger, you have lots of neutrons already. You've already gotten rid of all the electrons. And there you generally do have more antineutrinos. So you're more likely to have fast flavor conversions in mergers than in supernova, but it's not impossible. And we don't really know what happens if you do have the conditions somewhere for fast flavor oscillations. Are they just going to take over? I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. Right now, we know that it's unstable, so something will happen, but we don't really know what will happen.
Okay. I see Aman has a question as well.
Yes, Dr. Evans, a nice question. So these perturbations which you input in the model, which aid turbulence, so is there a strength parameter to these perturbations, and how does the aiding of turbulence scale with that strength of the perturbations?
Yeah, so there is. So it's a question of, we put in velocity perturbations, and so we do have, essentially we put in a Mach number of the velocity perturbations, and that you could get from stellar evolution. So these simulations that actually do the 3D hydrodynamics naturally resolve the convection that's happening in these shells, and you can take from them the convective Mach numbers that they see. The numbers we used are maybe a little bit big, but not unrealistically large compared to those simulations. And so the question of how does it scale? In some sense, you just want perturbation, you just want seeds that you can grow your turbulence off of. That's what's useful. Because it's not that the turbulence that is in the shells, that's not the turbulence we see in the gain region. It's just that we're able to is able to grow a lot faster because there's lots of breaking of symmetry there already. But what can also be important is density perturbations. And so whether the accretion of material on the shock is different in different regimes, if there's an area where it's lower because of some previous perturbation, then it's easier for the shock to blow up in that direction.
Okay, thank you. So basically, the perturbations you are putting is stellar evolution motivated.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, let me continue. So mostly when we model supernova, we just do neutrons, protons, and electrons, so hadrons. Neutrons and protons. But in reality, there's a whole QCD phase diagram. That's what you see here. And for high enough temperatures or high enough densities, then you expect transitions to other types of matter, whether you start to have hadrons other than neutrons and protons, like hyperons, lambdas, or whether you start to have deconfined quarks. So way up here, which is not where we are in supernova, but way up here, you have completely deconfined quarks. Supernovae, so normal nuclei are here, zero temperature, nuclear density. Neutron stars are also zero temperature, but they're much more dense. And supernova, not so dense, but they're hotter. And so they're kind of up in this range here. And much more neutron rich than equal numbers of neutrons and protons. So neutron stars, even though we have neutron stars here on this diagram, they're actually off the diagram in the third dimension, which is the isospin asymmetry, the ratio of neutrons to protons. So that can change where these boundaries are as well. And we don't really know exactly where these boundaries are. It's really hard to probe this diagram. But it's, you know, interesting to study in quark collapse. If you do have the appearance of quarks, what effect can that have on supernova? So here are a mass radius relation for neutron stars. Normally this kind of looks, normally it looks like this, where you have mass and radius for cold neutron stars. And so you've probably all seen a diagram like this before. This is for quark stars, and it's particularly for hot quark stars. So the kind of matter we have in supernova. And this is, so here we have different entropies. And these are the entropies we see in supernova. And so the cold stars would come up here and then come essentially straight down. These hot stars are much more extended because they have lots of thermal pressure. And for quark stars, we actually have this kind of third family of solutions. And so you have maxima here, where if you reach this point in the star and you make it a little more dense, then you actually have unstable configurations and the star will transition to a different configuration. So if you're here, then you'll transition over here. All of this area is unstable. So you'll transition over to this star, and that's a first order phase transition. And so that's what I'm going to explore coming up, stars that kind of take a path like this. If you're up here, then you just go to a black hole. There is no stable state to transition to. So we'll look at both of these coming up. So this is one of the first type where you have a transition from kind of an extended object to a more compact quark star. And in the process, you release a huge amount of extra gravitational binding energy, which goes, in this case, into blowing up the star. And so in this case, the star blows up. There's a movie of it here. So this is the normal hadronic evolution up to here, and then at close to 300 milliseconds, we have the phase transition. So you'll see the core collapse to a new state, and a new shock forms, and that new shock just completely takes over the old supernova shock and blows up the star. There's a huge, in this case, a huge amount of energy released and drives an explosion, even in 1D. This has been known to work, and this is the first time we've shown this in 2D. And there's a huge neutrino signal associated with it. When that shock runs through the neutron-rich material, heats it up, you get lots of positrons, and the positrons capture on the neutrons, and you get lots of antineutrinos coming out. Because this would be an example where you might have fast flavor transformations because you all of a sudden have a huge antineutrino density. Never thought of that before. That's interesting. Here, since we did in multi-D, we actually see, we were able to predict the gravitational wave signature because we can have multi-dimensional hydrodynamics. And we see, so the red lines in all these are the same equation state without the quarks. And so we don't have a transition in the red one, in the black one where we have this transition to quarks. Right at the phase transition, we have this huge burst of gravitational waves, high frequency, super short, only less than 10 milliseconds long, but very loud. So this is in the spectrogram, this is this 10 milliseconds surrounding the phase transition. This is the entire rest of the simulation. So higher frequency, louder, but as you can see, not really more detectable because the high frequencies are hard to see. But kind of cool. Such a signature would be very strong evidence for a phase transition happening in a galactic. It would have to be a galactic supernova to see this. So Schwei also looked at.
Evan, can I ask a question here? So yeah. Does this frequency, this higher frequency correspond to a certain kind of mode or family mode?
Yeah, it's essentially, the density goes up here, right? By a factor of several. And the characteristic emission frequency of a neutron star is very close to the dynamical frequency, which goes like the square root of the square root of the density. So essentially you just have a much more compact object that is a higher dynamical frequency. And so that's why you get higher frequency gravitational waves.
Okay, so in the other case, this very dense object does not oscillate as much? That's what
you're saying. Well, it's the red one here. It does, it's just at lower frequencies. And the power that you get out has a frequency dependence as well.
Okay.
And so there is, it does emit, like in the first 250 milliseconds, but with or without the quarks, you essentially get the same gravitational wave signature. It's just this transition that gives very distinct signature.
Okay.
So Schwei, the trouble with that equation state was the maximum mass is less than two solar masses. So this was kind of a historical quark equation of state. Here is another equation of state that does have two solar masses, but the problem here is much harder to get explosion. So when the phase transition happens, you don't have as much energy released. And so it's harder to drive an explosion. And I'll talk about that in a second. But we see kind of a much more wide range here, and we've done this with many progenitors. So these progenitors just go directly to, they form a neutron star, but then before they undergo the phase transition to quark matter, they're already above the maximum mass that the quark can withstand. And so they just go right to black holes. So this was, if you remember, the phase diagram, that's these guys up here. They reach this maximum and now they're unstable and they collapse, but there's nothing else. And so they just go right to a black hole. These guys undergo the transition to a quark star. They don't have enough energy to blow up. And so they sit there and oscillate for a while and then continue to accrete and eventually form a black hole. So this is a phase transition on the way to black hole formation. And this is this other category in here where you transition to here, but then you continue to accrete and eventually you'll become too massive and collapse. And then some of these lower guys have a much smoother phase transition. So it's not really a first order phase transition. it's more like these guys down here, where they just slowly transition from hadronic matter to quark matter. You don't really get any kind of strong dynamics. So we see kind of all three of these types. This, where you do have this transient, or where you have the transition to a quark star and you do have kind of a dynamic change, the proneutron star, it's not able to blow it up, but there is lots of excess energy there. So it does just sit there and ring for a long time. And so we have kind of periodic oscillations in the neutrino signature and in the shock radius and the central density as it just kind of sits there and rings down. These are spherically symmetric simulations. And so the multidimensional character will probably be different than what you see here. But overall, they will be qualitatively similar. And they're even in this area, there's kind of two regimes. So there's this regime where you undergo the transition and then the shock kind of goes out, but it doesn't go out very far. It only goes out to maybe 100 kilometers, less than 100 kilometers. And then it just sits there and kind of oscillates and then eventually forms a black hole. We also have types where that are more energetic. So more energy is released in the phase transition and the shock can start to propagate out to large radii. And so here, you know, a few hundred kilometers, 1,000 kilometers, maybe even further, the shock goes out. And then these are spherically symmetric simulations. So, and these particular ones end up not blowing up. But in multi-D simulations, you know, with the added effect of turbulence, these ones would probably blow up. So there is kind of this regime here where you have the phase transition and then you probably could blow up and avoid the black hole formation at late times. This energy release we kind of understand from this here. This is a plot of as a function of entropy now. So for all these different colors, how much energy is released when you transition from this star to this star? So just what is the gravitational binding energy difference of the two stars here with the same baryonic mass? And that's the solid red line. And as you go to higher and higher entropies, there's more and more energy released in that transition. And we see that in our simulations as well, that there's more and more, these stars represent the kinetic energy after the transition. And so these higher stars with higher entropy, which correspond to kind of this second set of models here, have more energy. And so they're kind of closer to explosion. And then if you go a little bit higher, then you're in this regime here where you just collapse to a black hole. And even though there's more energy, you're not able to revive the shock. Okay. Any questions about the quark stuff? No. Okay. Then let me briefly talk about normal equations of state then without quarks, so just hadronic matter. These are some examples of some of the equations of state we use. I'm going to talk about this gray one, this SRO equation of state. So it's this gray one here. This is from Andre Schneider. And what he's done is he's created the ability to systematically change nuclear properties and get finite temperature equations of state out. So even though there's only 10 here, this one gray equation of state, actually he's done, lots of equations of state, but what I'm going to show you, he's used over 100 different equations of state, varying individual nuclear properties and looked at their effect on quark collapse supernova. So he's changed things like the high density pressure, and this changes what the maximum mass of the equation of state is. He's changed the incompressibility, and so that kind of changes the radius of the neutron star. He's changed the symmetry energy and the slope of the symmetry energy, and that changes kind of the low density behavior of these cold neutron stars. And then he's also changed the effective mass prescription in these equations of state. And that really does nothing for cold neutron stars. But the effect of mass really comes in to play when you talk about the thermal effects of the material. So it's what is the response, or it affects the pressure and the energy density of hot material. And so we don't really see any effect in cold neutron stars, but this parameter set actually shows the largest impact in core collapse simulations. So that's what Andre showed. In this work, and these are six three-dimensional simulations where he increased the effective mass from low values. And this is where you have low effective mass gives high thermal pressure. And this causes the neutron stars to be big, and the neutrino heating ends up being less because they're not as compact and the neutrinos, not as much energy is released. So these low effective masses lead to failures, but as you increase the effective mass, you get less and less thermal pressure, and that allows you to have hotter and hotter neutrinos and more neutrino heating, and you can transition to explosions. So, and he's done simulations in 1D, these are 3D, but he's done simulations in 1D exploring all the other parameters to show that there is not really a big effect of these other parameters on the core collapse dynamics. This effective mass definitely has the largest effect. Okay, I'm gonna skip that. Any questions about that? Okay, I'm also gonna skip this neutrinos as messengers, where you can ask me about the details if you want, but we show that for galactic supernova, so within the canonical galactic distance is 10 kiloparsecs, that we're able to, with current detectors like IceCube, determine the distance to these supernova from the neutrinos alone to less than 5%. And so this is really important for our ability to follow up a neutrino, because the neutrinos come before the photons, to be able to have a fast response to any electromagnetic signature that there might be by knowing precisely where it might be coming from in the galaxy. So you can ask me more details if you want to know how we do that. But then maybe for the last few minutes, I'll talk about parameterized explosions. And this comes back to Eric's question of, what's going on in those plots where we see all those, some explosions, some failures. Yeah. It's really hard to do that study that they did in 3D. It's never been done before, 14 models. But it's kind of what you need to do if you want to understand the full parameter space of progenitor models. And even that alone is maybe not enough, because there are so many progenitors out there. And so people try and do it in 1D, coming up with systematic ways of blowing up stars and then exploring many stars in 1D. So here, for example, is 200 stars. And they have five different ways of characterizing their explosion. And so they have a model. Here, it's neutrino heating, that they tune to match the properties of 87A. So they have a model with parameters that they can change. When they reproduce 87A with different progenitors, that's what these five different models are, then they take those parameters and apply it to many stars in order to see what all those other stars would do in the same response. And so green here are successful explosions and black are unsuccessful explosions. And there's some kind of fallback supernova in here, which is the cyan. So generally, you could consider there, in the context of their model, robust explosions where it doesn't really matter what progenitor, what parameterization you take, they all blow up. So that would be these guys down here, very confident that stars up to 15 solar masses should explode. And then here, for example, between 22 and 25, you can be very confident that within their model, doesn't matter what the parameterization is, they're all going to fail and make black holes. The trouble is when you compare to multidimensional simulations, things don't match up very well. So for example, we simulated this progenitor in multi-D and we didn't get it to explode. even though all five parameterizations explode here. We simulated this one, which has no explosions in this model here, but we did get an explosion. And very similar for all these higher mass models, and particularly for the 22, 23, 24, and 25. Here there's absolutely no explosions, there's maybe only one explosion, but we get very robust explosions for all four of these models. So the question is the how good is the parameterization? And of course, the key in supernova simulations to get them explode, why do they not explode in spherical symmetry? Why do they not blow up in 1D, but they do blow up in multi-D is because the turbulence. And so a method that we kind of thought would be important is to come up with a model for the turbulence and put that in 1D simulations to see how well we can then parameterize the explosions. So we evolve a turbulent kinetic energy that we source by convectively unstable regions in our star. And then that turbulent pressure aids in the explosion. So that's what we did. This is an example of that. We have parameters, just like any parameterized model. And as we tune up this mixing length parameter, the effect of the turbulent energy and the turbulent pressure becomes stronger, and we can have an explosion even in 1D. And we tune this, we pick our mixing length to match a 3D simulation, the shock evolution of a 3D simulation. So that's what we do here. Here's another example. This is in full GR. So this one is just Newtonian with an effective potential. This is a full GR code. Luca from Notre Dame implemented this in this 3D code in this 1D code, and compared it to a full GR simulation, and gets a similar kind of, is able to model the explosion in 1D again.
So Evan, just a question. So on that, so you said that turbulence and whatever the other pressure is crucial. So to what level does the cascade goes? So how deep do you have to explore in wavelength before you actually transfer all that energy? Or is it more like a macroscopic effect? Is it kind of on short scale or big scales?
Yeah, so it's not like we're not doing a subgrid model for turbulence. And it's really what's an important I would say the more important things are the large scale structures that you have in the turbulence, which push out the shock. So in 2D, for example, with the inverse cascade, simulations in 2D explode much more easily than in 3D because you have this large scale turbulence that helps drive the explosion. And the large scales is helpful for pushing out the shock.
I see. So you don't need a lot of energy that you have localized. It's just some amount of energy or some amount of pressure globally. Interesting.
It's not that there is dissipation at some scale and that gives extra heating. That's not, okay, so this is then kind of our parameter space for these same models here with different mixing lengths now. And this one is kind of the one that best matches kind of several constraints. And so we have explosions for these lowest mass models. We have some that don't explode here between 13 and 15, and then kind of off and on up here. What's most different from this previous method is that these stars up here between 20 and 25 do explode when we have the turbulence model rather than just adding more neutrino heating. So this is one kind of very different method than to the neutrino heating method that we think is important. And actually, so the 13 to 14, again, coming back to Eric's question, our results, which is this for 1.25, so this strip along here, actually match very well these 3D simulations from the Princeton group, including whether or not they explode. So we also don't get the 13, the 14, and the 15 to blow up. but then also in the explosion times. So a lot of these times agree quite well with each other. Whereas this, I don't mean to pick on this method, it's really any of these parameterized models that use neutrino heating to drive the explosion. Often you get explosions very late and they don't really one-to-one match up with the multidimensional simulations. And Luca has done this. So one slight difference from the that what you get when you have the full GR, Luca has showed that these models in the 20 to 25 region, in the GR case, they are harder to blow up than in the effective potential case. So it seems like he still gets that the 13 and the 14 and the 15 don't blow up, but he gets that the 20 and the 20 to 25 do blow up for some values of his mixing length, but there is also some values that they fail. And so it seems to be preferentially these higher mass models are harder to blow up in GR, full GR, than with this effective potential. Okay, so that's everything. Thanks everyone for listening. And I'll be more than happy to answer any more questions.
Thank you, Evan, for the nice talk. Any more questions? Yeah, Eric, I guess Eric has a question. Oh, that's...
No, I don't, I'm applauding.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, Evan. So in the case of no explosion, does all the progenitor mass finally goes into the remnant?
Maybe not all of it. So definitely most of it from the core region will, and so you'll probably get a black hole. If there's any bit of angular momentum in the outer layers out at 10 to the 13 centimeters, then that's probably not going to make it into the black hole. And so it'll probably form some sort of disk, and maybe it could be ejected, maybe it would be accreted, but that kind of depends on the angular momentum profile.
Okay.
For the okay. Outer regions.
I see Luis has a question and then Daniel.
Yeah, so I should know the answer to this question, but I don't. So for 3G detectors, so for what we have now, it's only galactic. But when you go to 3G, how much farther can you go? Not a lot, but how many more galaxies can you include?
Yeah, I don't know. So like the galactic center is 10 kiloparsecs. The Andromeda is like 300 kiloparsecs. It's even more than that.
It's so it doesn't look like we're going to be able to get there. It's not going to get
So I mean, a factor of 10 in sensitivity gets you a factor of 10 in distance, which is maybe Andromeda, but not really. You might even need a factor of 50.
Right, okay. All right, goodbye.
Yeah, so a lot of the supernova emission is at higher frequencies. And so, you know, if the higher frequency response is preferentially improved over the lower frequency response, then maybe.
Okay.
There's also, you know, there's a difference between detecting it and seeing if you have a trigger from something else, whether or not it was there, right? So
right. Yeah,
sure. There was a recent paper that did take a bunch of 3D models and explore kind of where they were detectable to, and but I think next generation is still maybe not very very much higher rates than currently. I think mm-hmm. even current detectors have trouble seeing the whole galaxy.
Yep. Yeah, okay.
Daniel.
Yeah, thanks, Evan, for a really nice talk. I have two questions, actually. So one just like a tiny follow-up of one of Louis' questions earlier. So regarding the mixing length transport, so it really seems you need to essentially, would it be fair to say that you don't need turbulence, some sort of small-scale turbulence on some dissipation scale to create heat, but rather what you need to do is really to transport heat or, say, binding energy from the protoneutron star out to the sort of to the stalled shock. Is that what essentially your mixing length ansatz shows? So essentially, you really need the turbulence for like large scale sort of heat transport.
I mean, we need the turbulence to increase the Reynolds stress, because that ends up coming into the shock jump not the shock jump conditions, but the balance at the shock.
Mm-hmm.
So that you just get from having anisotropic motions, which come naturally from the turbulence.
Okay, thanks. And so the second question I had is, so there's lots of discussions right now, obviously on the lower mass gap. And so there are a few sort of credible black hole candidates now in there, and LIGO might have identified maybe a few more. So what's your take on this from essentially these quark collapse supernova simulations that you do? I remember that a lot of these mass gap arguments were based on these one-dimensional supernova explosion simulations, but now that you're adding this mixing length parameter and you get sort of more explosions, so what does that mean in terms of the lower mass gap?
Yeah, I mean, so the lower mass gap is really motivated by the galactic black holes, right? I don't know if it was ever motivated from the quark collapse theory. I mean, at least currently, we don't necessarily have problems making low mass black holes. You just need to have failures in some particularly lower mass stars, which failures kind of down here at these low masses, these stars don't have a lot of mass, especially if they're stripped, and there's some down here too at 15. If they're stripped, then they're only going to have say 5 solar masses, and so it's not too hard to motivate a low mass black hole from the quark collapse theory side.
Okay.
The question is maybe where it comes from, whether it's are they stripped envelopes, are they failed explosions, or are they maybe they're these cyan ones, which is a successful explosion but then fallback. Yeah, so there's a little bit of question of what is the mechanism for the low mass black holes, but I don't think necessarily hard to explain.
Okay, thanks.
Well, just to follow up on that, I think that's a very interesting perspective, because people have made a big deal of the mass gap, and I guess where it came from in the lore was not clear to me, but I guess it came from biased observations more than anything, you know, resting on fundamental physics or anything that might be securely known. I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay. It is true that 10 years ago, or maybe 15, if you asked someone to make this plot, it would be green all the way up to 20, right? No one would say that 15 solar mass stars are making black holes and failing to blow up. And so from that perspective, it would be hard to get someone to say, to make a low mass black hole, all I need to do is not blow up a 13 solar mass star. That would almost be absurd, because people would say, well, if the 13 doesn't blow up, then the 14, the 15, the 16, all the way up doesn't blow up, and that's too many black holes. But once you start having, once you think that, you know, there's not just one mass cut that where you stop having neutron stars and start having black holes, then the landscape's a lot bigger.
So Evan, just to entertain, just keep going along those lines. Now I want to do the opposite. I want to form as small a black hole as I can. So as you understand better the principles behind making the collapse, do you foresee a chance of just getting, as opposed to everything green, everything black?
Um,
Like how I now want to play the exercise. How a smaller black hole could we see forming?
Right. I think
black hole small, but then I want to, from a realistic thing, go as slow as possible.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be fine tuning, but I don't see a problem with forming a neutron star and having exactly the right amount of fallback you need to push it over the edge.
Okay, so just barely, but could you conceive forming a black hole to just with less than two solar masses? That's what I'm saying. Just throw it, just some shock that sends, or some wave that goes inwards, compresses the matter, blows everything else apart so that it never gets time to grow significantly its mass, and I end up with a one solar mass black hole. You would say that's impossible?
I would, it would be very hard, I think, to do that. Yeah.
Okay.
I have one example of a way to kind of do that. Do I have the plot? I can get a plot that is kind of close to what you're saying, although it's very hard to do it, but it's kind of close.
And this goes back to this is also another observation people have made. So maybe kicking and screaming, you push them to give away the mass gap, but it's going to be impossible for them to say, oh yes, I'll accept that if I don't have any evidence and I only know that this is a compact object of 1.7 solar masses, I know for a fact it's a neutron star. That there will be many that will kind of subscribe to that sentence. And I have heard it. So I'm just trying to see, can it be ruled out?
I mean, I don't know of any mechanism to do that. Although, okay. I mean, you're right that it would be possible, right? I mean, there's nothing that theoretically says it can't be a black hole as long as you have a mechanism to make it.
Right.
But I think the mechanism would be hard. Yeah.
Okay.
The one possibility, but this is stretching it. So this is a plot of the maximum gravitational mass as a function of entropy, constant entropy throughout the neutron star. And so this, all these equations state, and these are varying these effective masses that I had talked about before. And so the cold neutron stars all have the same maximum mass, 2.2. And then depending on what the effective mass is, as you go to higher values of entropy, you either can support a larger neutron star. And so, you know, for these guys, even 2.8 solar masses, just from thermal, added thermal support. But for some choices of the effective mass, you do have a slightly negative slope here. And so in principle, and I don't know if this one is below it or not, the crosses are where the black holes actually form. Here you might be forming a neutron star or a black hole with a gravitational mass that's less than the cold baryonic value.
Sure.
And so maybe you could
principle take, behind allowing you to do that.
It's just the I think it's just a matter of the thermal structure and the resulting pressures that you get out. I mean, these are just TOB solutions.
Okay. Thank you.
The only thing is that if this is in reality, if you do this, you still have a whole star that you have to then stop accreting, right?
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. Bring it.
Okay. Any other questions for Evan? Well, if not, let's thank Evan again for a very nice talk.